is they made the new Star Wars where they went back to the Death Star and they went in the vent again. How lame was
that?
Did
they really? I don't remember that.
Again, they went back to to a Death Star planet-killing thing and went in the vent and blew stuff up again, as if we wouldn't notice. Jake, I feel like I have to buy a drum set. I want to be able to
do, welcome to Overcrest.
Welcome to Overcrest. I need a drum set. I want to do the doom from the song. I want to be able to sit down and do that part. That's it.
It's just always going to be in front of you, and you just have to do that every time.
Not every time, but I want to be able to. I want it to be able to something that I could sit down at a drum set anywhere and just go doom with the song playing. Anyway. Welcome to Overcrest. Yeah. I'm Chris. You're Jake.
And I am Jake.
It's been a while. Yes,
that's correct.
I don't know what's going on for this episode. You've put something together.
I have no clue.
None. Yeah, I promise.
This is a history episode. Yep. And, you know, as we occasionally do, we're straying non-automotive here, right?
Is it history or is it more of a throwback? Because history seems so... I've got a 500-page book. I have to take a test afterward. Please don't quiz me. That kind of thing. So
what should it be like? I'm telling you a very interesting story. Like, because that's what
time.
It is.
Overcrest story time.
Overcrest.
I'm gonna sit on the little blankie. I'm gonna get my legs.
Get
up.
Your binky. Yeah.
I'm ready to go.
As we tell our son, like, okay, we're gonna go read a book, have story time. So get
that
your binky.
Good. I love it.
Okay. So, like I said, we're straying a bit non-automotive on this one. Which, let's be honest, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a pretty good podcast, not a pretty good car podcast. We're good.
That's right.
Let's hear it.
So, okay. Chris, this week, I'm going to regale you with the story that changed the very state of warfare. It began a new era of geopolitics.
The history of guns.
And indeed, changed the very course of history.
All right.
It's not the story of guns, no. But before we dig in, we have to set the stage a little bit, okay? When is this time period? What's going on in geopolitics and in news? Go ahead and play that first clip that I have
ready for us. Let's do it. Uh-huh. All right. No clouds in my stones. Let it rain.
Hello, 2007. 3, 2, 1.
Excitement and relief as the Large Hadron Collider subsystems whir back into action. Colliding its first protons, physicists and engineers have been planning this part of the experiment for 15 years.
And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
Look at the 35W bridge that collapsed during rush hour traffic, killed 13 people and injured 145 others.
It's called the Tesla. It's made in California. It's based on the Lotus Elise. And as a result, it looks good.
Analyzing the millions of mortgages that were bundled into those mortgage-backed securities that Wall Street was peddling. It found that the subprimes, loans to the least creditworthy borrowers, were defaulting.
The Mortgage Bankers Association says 1 out of 10 Americans is now behind on their mortgage. That's the most since they started keeping records in 1979.
As Americans try to keep terrorists at bay by building a better nation.
So that this is we're talking 2007. That's like a 2007 recap.
2007.
What were you doing in 2007?
Did you share the video? Because I wasn't able to see the video this
time. Yeah, the video played. Yeah, I saw it all.
Good. Because I spent some time on that, Chris.
Yeah, what were you doing in 2007?
Do you feel like you set the stage? So yeah, 2007, it was in many ways a turning point. I had just started my undergrad degree. I was in college. Jake was in college.
I was talking shit on the internet in 2007.
Yeah, that tracks.
Guaranteed, that's what I was up to.
It was kind of like...
On the forums, and yes.
Yeah. You know? So some of the highlights there is kind of a more innocent time because way before
unless COVID you had a mortgage.
And a global pandemic, right? But it was just beginning of the housing bubble bursting, right? The iPhone was just announced. That was the iPhone 1. CERN had just gone online with Large Hadron Collider, was a big deal. The
did you see that now we need a new one? We need a new collider. That collider is not good enough. We need a new collider.
Oh, it's not, so they're not big enough.
It's not, okay. The collisions aren't colliding enough. They're not collidable enough at all for anyone. So we've got to do a new collider.
It was a big deal in 07.
It was. It was.
The particles got tired of it.
Something I guess
like that.
So.
Who knows? Yeah. You remember the I-35 bridge collapse? It was global news, but it was especially a big deal here.
Everybody's
in
Minnesota. Yeah, I drove over the bridge about 25 minutes ago. But realistically, I absolutely did drive across that bridge like 30 minutes before it collapsed, which is like super like it's almost as if you're talking to somebody about the weather. Hey, how was the weather over by you? Oh, I drove over that bridge 20 minutes ago. It doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah. This was the first time we had ever heard the word Tesla, right? Mm-hmm. This was the Tesla Roadster had just come out, the one based on the Elise, and the U.S. housing bubble burst. And of course, the war on terror continued to rage in the Middle East. And it's that last point, Chris, that we're going to focus on in Iran specifically. You may recall that although Afghanistan and Iraq were the focuses of the conflict, the so-called Axis of Evil included other countries as well. Go ahead and play clip 2 so we can get a little color on that.
I know we have some listeners in Iran, so I will just say it's Iran, not Iran, just so we don't get in trouble later.
Iran?
Every time someone says Iran, we get in trouble. It's Iran. Yeah.
Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror. While an unelected few repress the Iranian people's hope for freedom. Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
Iran specifically had quickly become a global threat, not only with its harboring of terrorists, but with its now burgeoning nuclear capabilities. It was, to say the least, alarming. You see, as early as the beginning in the 1990s, Russia had been providing nuclear resources to Iran, including loaning out their scientists and sharing technical plans. And up until the early 2000s, Iran had claimed that any and all nuclear activity they were doing was peaceful and simply for civilian usage, such as creation of nuclear power plants. Like, we're doing research here, but we're trying to make clean energy, right? Don't worry about it. Well,
here's the thing, like, as a comment on that,
sure.
No country should be restricted from having cheap energy. This is like such like
correct.
This, just for their economy and the human beings that live there, this is such a really delicate subject of
exactly.
And that's why it's so difficult to not allow a country to use nuclear energy, which is clean and cheap and good for the environment, number one, and it's good for the people that live there. So it's hard, especially for a country that's so oppressed and so I'm sure it's still an amazing, beautiful country. It used to be much better. There used to be girls walking around in bikinis in Iran
back
in the day.
Yeah.
And now it's you get dragged out by your feet if you had a bikini on. It's a little bit different.
For sure. Yeah. So the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, made several inspections of development sites in Iran, finding that not only was the program way more advanced than anyone had suspected, but they also had exposed a previously undisclosed enrichment facility in the city of Natanz. So things are maybe not just for civilian usage, and at the very least, they weren't telling us everything they were doing, and it was way more advanced. So before we kind of dig into that any further...
What would you do if you were them? Let's, like just to be devil's advocate, okay? You've got the biggest... Now, to be fair, I'm tempted to get into this a little bit, but I don't... Can you blame them for, like, trying to figure out a way to get these weapons? Like, everything that's going on there with, like, the dictatorship, they're gonna try. They're going to do it, right? They're going to give it.
Yeah, like, anyone in the geopolitical landscape wants to have that same capability, right? It's hard to it's hard to regulate for sure.
But you're in a boxing ring with a bunch of other dudes that have huge weapons, right? I was going to say something.
Thank you.
And here you are with like a, you know, you don't have a big stick. You've got a little stick unless you've got the nuke, right?
Yeah,
you
100%.
Have no
They're
place at the table in geopolitics.
Nope.
You just don't. You don't have. Like,
I mean, aside from trade, but when it comes to like warfare, absolutely not.
No, yeah, but
you don't.
They don't have anything. They don't have any natural resources over there other than oil.
Oil.
It's just like,
well, oil's a big deal. Turns out.
Yeah, they don't have as much as some other places, and it's just
you
like.
Know what? I know it's so. Yeah, it's tricky, and I'll get to kind of like the how delicate some of the like geopolitical and diplomacy can be. But before we do go into that, do you know what is not delicate but is still, you know, cutting edge? We're talking about cutting edge technology.
I would
CSF
go with
cooling.
Yeah, like a radiator sounds like it would be super high tech.
They're at the forefront of quality technology products at a fair price with a rich history stretching over 7 decades. We're talking about history here. They definitely have it. And they provide the best high-performance OEM cooling systems on the market today. CSF offers over 3,000 different cooling applications for the most popular makes and models on the road today. From classic copper brass radiators for Land Cruisers, Jeeps, and Datsuns, vintage 80s Mercedes like behind Chris, BMW also behind Chris, and Isuzu Troopers.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
I know. I'm getting there. They have Porsche as well, and all the way up to your modern new vehicle. Check out their expanding Classic Series lineup. That's very cool. And be sure to check out everything they offer at csfrace.com or on social media. All right, so before we go any further with like Iran and their capabilities and what's going on there, I thought it would be prudent and maybe a good idea to give a bit of a primer on the science behind nuclear reactions and what that actually means. And when we talk about nuclear activities, be it a power plant or atomic bomb, the process we're talking about and is taking place is nuclear fission. Now, Chris, I know you start to zone out as soon as I start getting technical on these, so I'm going to make it brief and exciting just for you. Okay?
I appreciate that. Let's do it.
I'm also going
to
make it
for everybody that we don't want falling asleep while they drive.
I know, but I like to tease you. Right. I'm also going to make it as simple as possible so that like even your feeble little mind can understand these concepts.
Yeah.
Okay. You're welcome. Yes. So here goes. Everything is made up of atoms. Everything. We know this.
Except dark matter.
Still with me? No. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about last week when we talked about dark matter.
I know. And we're like, what is that? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Each chemical element on the periodic table is an atom with a slightly different makeup of some atomic particles. And I know I'm already losing you because I just mentioned subatomic particles. So I'm going to introduce an analogy here. Right?
All right.
And this won't be an ideal analogy, but think of atoms as cars.
All right.
All right. And each type of atom is made up of the same three components. Let's think of them as a family in this case, right? So in a nuclear family, pun intended, by the way.
Very good. Very
there's
good.
There's a mom, the dad, and the kids, okay? So in the atomic world, these serve as our protons, neutrons, and electrons. So you have all these different cars driving around made up of slightly different combinations of people in them, and that's your different elements. Different atoms. Nuclear fission reactions occur when an atom absorbs an additional particle and then subsequently splits into two or more smaller atoms. This reaction creates not only multiple smaller elements, but also a colossal amount of energy. So,
would this be like someone just getting in the car at a stoplight?
Oh, yep. So picture this. I got it. I got it already. The Kluel family is driving along in your car. Okay. Let's say it's your Golf R.
Got it.
The Golf R. So you're driving along all happy. The car is perfectly full. You're all comfortable. You're in the driver's seat. Jess riding shotgun and the girls are in the back seat there. And all of a sudden, you're driving on the freeway and you see me on the side of the road. I'm looking for a ride. I got my thumb out. There's probably like one of my cars broke down. It's
most
terrible.
Likely.
But you're such a nice friend that you pull over and decide you can help me in my time of need.
Yep.
So I squeeze into the car. But as you can imagine, it's kind of a tight squeeze between the girls, or like one has to scoot over and the Golf R is just kind of getting too full. Right.
It is. But there's still plenty of headroom for you back there. Let's be honest.
That's very true. That's very true. That's good. So, but like I'm crammed in the back seat between your daughters and they're complaining that they don't have enough room and you're getting stressed because we're fighting in the back seat. And Jess, for some
Why
reason,
are you
suddenly
fighting with my children, Jake?
Because
Grow
we have no
up,
room,
dude.
Chris. There's
Grow
no
up.
Room.
grow
and,
up, man.
And, like, Jess is getting upset, and she has a headache, and, like, her back hurts, and the whole trip is falling apart. And to top things all off, we're all hot because the AC can't keep up, and we break out into an all-out fight, Chris. Mm. Now, admittedly, this is where the analogy completely falls apart, because somehow, magically, we all explode into... turn into two separate cars where everyone is much more comfy. Like, I don't know, maybe your Golf is actually a transformer and it transformed into two motorcycles with sidecars or something. Ooh, right.
Yeah, so you would like that.
However you want to picture it, the end result is we're all much more comfortable in our new state. And during this magical process, we released a ton of energy, maybe in the form of stress. We all let our stress off. And that'll create a chain reaction where all the other cars on the freeway around us also start turning into motorcycles. It's craziness. And so that, Chris, is nuclear fission. That is a perfect analogy for nuclear
fission. Perfect analogy. Absolutely perfect.
Perfect.
Except I don't know that I would have picked you up. I don't know.
Oh, come on.
I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, come on. Well, yeah.
I have been known to pick up strangers, but you? Eh.
You have. And actually, in the 9/11, that also would have been an example because that was way too full.
Yeah, yeah.
With your hitchhikers and their stuff
with the Death Valley.
Wherever that was. Yeah.
Giant packs full of water. Yeah, that was interesting.
Why was no one in the... there was one person in the front seat. All right, anyways. The most common type of car or element used for fission in uranium, we're back to nuclear science here, is uranium. Because it's easy to initiate a reaction and also control it, okay? Now, there's several naturally occurring isotopes of uranium. There's different, like, types or versions of the same element
I
of
know
uranium,
that from the Jack
and
Ryan
you can
books.
Find it.
Because you can look up the isotope based on the nuclear energy that was blown up or on the warhead. You can find out where that nuclear weapon came from the different isotopes.
Interesting. Yes. Right. Well, one particular version is that which can actually support fission, which is uranium-235. This is like the element you think of when you think of nuclear reactions, uranium-235. So while uranium is found in nature, like it is just naturally occurring. It's not something that you make in a lab. Only 1% of any and all uranium is the uranium-235 variety. Okay. So while the uranium doesn't need to be pure 235 in order for a nuclear reaction to take place, it does need to somehow be increased. So that's why if there's a deposit of like uranium ore, it's not just turning into a nuclear bomb by itself. It's because it's not pure enough of that 235, right?
You know how much uranium-235 the United States has, like, that we can mine?
Oh, no, I don't.
Zero. None. We don't have any.
It's, none
it's
of it.
All in, like,
we didn't find
like
any here.
Eastern Europe, Russia, and I think Canada. I think you can get there, but we don't have any.
Canada. Interesting. Yeah.
Okay. At least our hat has some.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so it needs to be basically refined or distilled in the term of like alcohol, right? You need to make a still. And so a nuclear power plant requires 5 to 10% concentration of 235. So it's not all uranium-235. It's uranium, but it needs to be enhanced. So there's more 235.
It's so like 5 to 10% putting salt on everything you eat. It tastes fine.
How?
But it... Because you're just adding a little bit of salt.
But it's not good enough.
But it's not good unless you add the salt.
Yeah, so 5 to 10% more salt, and now you can use it in a nuclear power plant. Once the purity increases beyond 20%, though, that is when you can use it in a nuclear bomb. Okay.
What was the percentage?
So that's what's... 5 to 10 is a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
20% is a bomb. So that's where, like, there is kind of this fine line, and you can try to define, like, okay, if they're doing nuclear activity, how far are they enriching the uranium? Like, that's kind of the distinction. So how do you purify or distill this uranium, Chris? That's where the process they call enrichment. Yes, it is. So they call it enrichment. And this bit is very important to our story. Okay, so uranium enrichment uses a gas centrifuge, which is basically just a rapidly rotating tube where gasified uranium is injected. The centrifugal force acting on the gas in this spinning tube separates out the heavier 235 that we want. The problem is, if you want to do anything at scale with uranium, you need a lot of these centrifuge tubes. I'm talking a lot, like tens of thousands of these
things. How big are these things?
They're, I want to say they could fit on your desktop.
Okay.
That's so you essentially have
an enormous underground warehouse full of these things.
Full of thousands of these, correct.
Thousands of these, and they're all doing their thing. They're all being monitored by a computer.
Correct, 100%. And that is exactly what the IAEA found in Iran, which for obvious reasons isn't good if they had this whole plant that they weren't telling anyone about. Like, right. Hold on, that's no bueno. But here's the issue, as you talked about. Diplomatic geopolitics is a tricky business. Remember, Iran publicly claims that these nuclear activities are simply for creating power plants. It's just civil. Like, yep. It's not a wartime activity. So if we simply decided to bomb the hell out of these facilities, it could be seen as killing innocent civilians, or at the very least, like just a very rash and brash decision. It was also heavily fortified. This facility itself, covered by 22 meters of earth. I didn't make that.
Didn't you see
non-metric.
The new Top Gun where there was like a little vent? Why didn't they just drop a missile?
Right. Which is also ironically just like Star Wars. There's always a little vent.
There's always a
did
little
you,
vent.
Did you realize that? You're like, yeah. Oh, wait, this is Luke Skywalker?
You know what sucked? 100%. Is they made the new Star Wars where they went back to the Death Star and they went in the vent again. How lame was
did
that?
Did they really?
They
I don't remember
did it
that.
Again. They went back to the to a Death Star planet-killing thing and yep. went in the vent and blew stuff up again, as if we wouldn't notice. As if we wouldn't
well,
notice.
I know. And, then, and the whole Top Gun
and
thing.
And then they yeah. used a ship to travel at light speed to blow up uh-huh. one of the giant Star Wars ships. One of the giant enemy ships. They just okay. crashed a ship that went light speed right into
Which
it.
Which movie was this? I don't remember any of this.
I think Rogue.
There's one, so like, many.
So many. But then I'm just thinking, so why don't we just run ships at light speed through any of the ships? Why don't we just use light speed propulsion weapons?
I didn't like, you're right.
It
I feel
ruined
like there's
everything.
Some weird science breakdown there. Yeah.
Yeah, it ruined everything. Right. Just like vents.
All right. Vents like ruin vents. Every heavily fortified complex. Yeah. So this place is designed to be impenetrable. And there's also the dicey little detail that this complex, depending on the amount of uranium that they were able to enrich, is itself kind of a giant nuclear bomb waiting to go off. So destroying it would be akin to setting off like a massive dirty bomb, even if we could blow it up.
Yeah, which is all the particles. And,
yeah, lastly, furthermore, there's no reason Iran wouldn't just spin up another enrichment facility just as quick that we don't know about.
Well,
so what
I have to imagine someone's helping them with this.
Yeah, we already established that Russia.
Yeah, I mean, we have to understand that that's what's happening yeah. right here, because Iran does not have the capability of making centrifuges
Correct.
And all this other. They have to get them from
Correct.
Somewhere.
Yeah. They do indeed. So what's to be done? Well, what did happen was sheer brilliance, and it ushered in a new era of warfare, a tactic that was so genius and clandestine that it wasn't even discovered until years after the fact. But before we get into that, we're going to get into something else. This sheer brilliance, Chris.
The brilliance
Petrolbox.
Of it? Ah,
the
sheer brilliance.
Brilliance of Petrolbox, monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiast, the car guy or gal in your life. Each month, they carefully select items, including tools, detailing supplies, apparel, garage gear, stickers, enamel pins, collectibles, tools, all to be sent right there to your doorstep. It's a curated selection, the latest, greatest gear in the industry. Actually, two different levels of subscription to choose from. Unlike inflation, Petrolbox prices did not go up. The Petrolbox Basic cost less than $20 a month at $19.95. The Petrobox Premium gets you even more gear, Chris, for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrolbox.com and be sure to use the code OVERCREST at checkout to get $6 off your first month. Okay.
Did you in your dive into nuclear energy and all this stuff, did you
yes.
before we get into what happened here? Now that I know where we're at, I know what we're talking about.
You but know what we're talking about?
I do.
The folder I sent you was probably also a giveaway.
It was. Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out why we don't have small nuclear reactors on, because we have these enormous.
We've talked about this. You're what? Let's have one at every street corner, neighborhood. As
why don't we have a neighborhood?
Reactor.
Why not?
Why don't we spread out the? Because there, you need to. There are bad actors, Chris, and you can't have the level of security that is required, you know, at every like municipality.
Having 5% uranium in a nuclear reactor that's built to do like 50 square city blocks, there's not enough uranium in that to do any real damage. It's just not
enough.
You don't
think so?
I don't think so.
It's still radiation.
Yeah, I
guess. It's also the transport of the radioactive material. We talked about also like how dangerous and the half-life of the waste, radioactive waste, yeah, even after the fact.
You just need to have some radioactive cats.
Correct. That is the way we do it. 100%.
That's a throwback to Radioactive Kitties episode 200 and something something. Go check it out. It's a great episode.
That was a really good one.
Radioactive Kitties. Yeah, it was pretty good.
I think it was. That was the name of it that we decided on. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So back to 2007. So by this time, the enrichment plant was up and running with somewhere around 87,000 centrifuges running at capacity. But there was a strange phenomenon happening, and it was a mystery, Chris. Let's play our next file to give us a little mood music as I describe this mystery.
All right, next one I've got is a video clip. Are you sure you don't want an audio clip?
Want an audio clip. Yeah.
All right. Well, hopefully this is the one. I got 50-50 shot, okay?
Okay. It should be just... Oh, yeah. Yep, that's it. All right. Ooh, it's a mystery, Chris. Can you turn it down a little bit? Can you turn it down just a hair?
It is. It's down. Okay. Maybe not for you, but it is for everybody else.
It's very loud for me. All right. So
suck it up.
These machines...
Enjoy it. Rock out.
These machines were failing at an alarming rate. Some sources report up to 30% of the devices would either burn out or catastrophically just disintegrate within days of weeks of being installed. And keep in mind that these are highly precise pieces of hardware. In order to separate the uranium, these slender tubes run at 63,000 RPM. And it's not like they were an inferior cobbled together system. These were state-of-the-art devices sourced through back channels. You know, it's like black market, as we talked about. So there's no reason for them to be failing. They were state-of-the-art, and the engineers and scientists at the Natanz facility, they were at their wit's end.
They were running Windows 95.
I don't know if that's true.
I bet it was Windows 95. I bet they were running Windows 2000 or something. Do you remember back in the day, like your buddy would have Windows 95 or 98, and you would have Windows 2000?
And then XP came out, and you're like, wait, what year is XP? They changed it. I don't like that at all.
I bet they had Windows XP running on these things. Yeah.
It might have been XP, which I don't think was a good OS from what I'm remembering.
No.
So every electronic control and monitor showed that everything was fine. And technical inspections, one after the other, showed that there was no reason at all for these things to fail. Specialists were called in to dismantle and identify the problem. And picture it, Chris. Like, I can only imagine the pressure that these guys were facing from the Islamic Republic of Iran itself. This isn't exactly
like, why are you scientists? Why are you so dumb? Like, what's going on? You know?
Yeah. Can't find the problem? Can't figure it out? I don't know. Maybe you're just going to disappear. Maybe your family does. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of pressure here to get this going. And software engineers were then brought in to ensure the computer programs running the systems were all running correctly and free from bugs. And yet, absolutely nothing was found. The problems continued without explanation. It's as if the entire program was cursed or there was a ghost in the machine. And indeed, there was. But here's the thing. It wasn't discovered until years later, seemingly by accident, at a completely unrelated location. Fast forward. Okay, that's actually perfect for this next part. Okay. Fast forward to 2010. Okay.
Yep.
Sergei Ulasin was a programmer and IT security expert working for a relatively unknown and small antivirus vendor from Belarus in Eastern Europe named Virus Blockada, which is really funny. Yeah, it was a Saturday afternoon, we happen to know, when Sergei received a persistent call, which was annoying since he was like at a wedding for his friend and it was the weekend. Who's bothering him? So his phone continued to ring. I don't know why that detail was like in the reports, but I included it because I thought it was funny. So his phone continues to ring, right? You can picture it. He's at his friend's wedding in Belarus, and he's Belarus? Like, it's the weekend, you guys. No, I'm going to go Belarus.
Oh, my gosh. That's
it's
like
Iran and Belarus.
Belarus? Sounds like Dolores' long
like
lost cousin.
Like Dolores. Yeah. She's Eastern European. Yeah. Oh. So the phone continued to ring. He finally answered the call, and he was met with a frantic voice on the other line. It was one of the antivirus clients from abroad, an Iranian company, more specifically.
I actually found his ringtone. Do you want to hear it?
I do want to hear this.
This is how I know you're too young. That's Windows 95 startup sound. You had Windows XP down, but Windows 95? Yeah, this is the one right here.
I thought it was my mystery music again.
No. Go ahead.
So the client explained that a whole host of the company's computers were crashing, presenting the infamous blue screen of death, Chris. Mm-hmm. And being a tech nerd, Sergey assumed that it was...
That's the solution.
He assumed it was a simple problem or incorrect configuration. Because, let's be honest, there's a reason all tech support people tell you to try turning it off and then on again to fix the problem. Because most people, when it comes to computers and technology, are just idiots.
It's true.
And most problems can be fixed just as easily. Like, just turn it off, turn it on again. He's like, why are you bothering me on a Saturday at my friend's wedding when you are just stupid and don't know how to work your computer?
Right.
But as Sergey listened to more details around the problem, oh, there it is.
Yep. This is actually a live look in at an Iranian nuclear centrifuge computer. Right.
No, see, this was completely unrelated. This was just some technical firm in Iran.
It always never gave any information either. This is what it says. It literally would always say this. Your device ran into
this is probably XP.
A problem and needs to restart. We're just collecting some error info and then we'll restart for you. Where did this error information go?
Sad face.
And nobody ever was like, oh, this is what the problem was. You didn't get an email back later that said, hey, we found out what your problem was. It was that website that you went to 1:33 a.m. on a Wednesday. You just maybe don't go to that website anymore.
That's not a good website. No.
That would have been
not
even
a good time to be browsing.
I almost spoiled it. Go ahead. Spoil it.
Okay. So as Sergey, this antivirus expert, listened in more detail to the problem, his annoyance turned to concern. At first, he's like, you guys are probably just idiots. It's probably something stupid. But then he was like, hold on. He was concerned and admittedly, at least I'd like to assume, a bit curious, right? It's the same problem that had been occurring on computers that were an existing operating system, and then they tried completely wiping them and installing a new copy of Windows. The same exact problem would happen. Like, hold on, that doesn't make any sense. So that's when he began to suspect a computer virus on their network. So on Monday, he went back into the office and he began looking into the matter by remotely accessing the Iranian computers.
There he is. This is him.
There he is.
That's right there. Right in the middle. Yeah, that's him on the computer.
So this is actually a look at that Iranian enrichment.
Whose picture is on the wall
this
here?
It's right here. I assume the Iranian president.
That's not the Iranian president.
Or leader or whoever. I don't know. It's maybe a footballer or something.
It could be a footballer. Yeah, it could be. I'm right.
Like, that makes sense. What is with their hats?
Their hair, they've got little masks on too, so the uranium doesn't get COVID.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Yes, that is exactly what happened. Okay, so Sergey's like poking around in their system remotely, and finally he finds this offending program. It was just causing the computer to crash. It was an unknown piece of software, and it was very strange. The way the code was hiding or distributed among other files was indicative of other malware or viruses that he had seen. Now, Chris, you and I are fairly tech savvy,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But in the interest of storytelling, I think it's prudent to take a look at computer viruses themselves, what they are,
yes,
and how they work. So malware is simply a portmanteau or a combination of the words malicious and software. Malicious software, malware. It's a type or any type of computer program intentionally designed to cause disruption to a computer, leak private information, gain unauthorized access, steal information, or just otherwise cause havoc, right? It's just a bad program.
It's not a virus.
Any type of
bad
program.
That's not what a virus is.
Is malware.
Yeah, there's a difference.
Correct. The term computer virus is a subcategory, technically, of malware. And the distinction is a virus is self-replicating. Mm-hmm. So malware, I could like give you and it'll just be annoying or whatever it does, or it's trying to steal your information, but it won't spread. Okay. So a virus spreads much like a biological virus. Right. That's why it's called as such. There's also the concept of a worm, which you may have heard of, which is a distinction of a computer virus in that a worm simply replicates or worms its way into a network without having to do anything else or cause any real harm. Right. So the worm is just the part that replicates. The payload, much like a bomb, is the part of the virus that actually does the damage.
Here it is right here.
We found it. Nice. You found it. That was really good. I'm glad you already found it. Hold on. What's really funny is like they're mixing binary code with HTML there. Yeah, I'm like, wait a minute, what are we doing? Yeah, no, encoding UTF-8? Yeah, that's just a web page. Okay, so interestingly enough, the concept of computer viruses, I had to look up kind of the history of it and deep dive. It predates computers themselves. The idea of a computer virus predates computers. How can
because
that be?
Because it's the same thing that happens to a human system with or biological warfare. Right?
Yes, I mean, if you
think,
in a way.
Like,
so
think about it.
Here's the thing. As early as 1949, a mathematician and physicist, John von Neumann.
German.
Gave a lecture on the theory. I think it was Austrian, actually, but yes. He gave a lecture on the, quote, theory and organization of complicated automata, describing how a then still hypothetical, mind you, computer program could be designed to replicate itself. The first actual computer virus was an experiment carried out in 1971. It was nicknamed the Creeper, and it was a program first deployed and detected on ARPANET, which is not to be confused with like the DARPA thing. ARPANET is like some other internal precursor to the actual internet, a forerunner to it, in the early 1970s. So Creeper.
Okay.
Creeper was this experimental self-replicating program written by Bob Thomas at BBN Technologies.
In a white van outside of high school.
That's Bob Thomas? That's who you're picturing?
Creeper. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So it used it to infect archaic DEC PD-10 computers, which are probably the size of like a gymnasium. And it simply displayed the message, I'm the Creeper, catch me if you can.
Ooh.
That was the whole virus. That was it.
Fun.
Since then, viruses continue to evolve, and the rise of antivirus software such as McAfee or Norton and all of the like have played a constant game of cat and mouse, right? A new virus comes out, then Norton will release a new version of their antivirus, or you just buy a Mac and don't have to worry about it. But...
Well, that's because
when Sergey discovered,
to be clear, what everybody doesn't realize is that a Mac is essentially running off, at least it was. I don't know. It's evolved so much, but it was basically Linux is what a Mac was. And it didn't run everything off of a registry, which is what Windows did. So everything on Windows had to be all the apps had to access the operating system to get the permissions to do what they wanted to do with Linux or with a Mac. Each application is operated in its own environment, so it doesn't have to like reach into a registry to get permissions to do things. It's more self-contained.
Got it. Okay, sure. I don't know if that's true or not.
Pretty
but sure. Okay,
I'm sure I'll
well,
be called out.
When Sergey
out if
discovered
I'm, if
this
I'm
virus, I am hoping so. Send all emails to Overcrest. So when Sergey discovered the virus on the Iranian's firm's network, it wasn't surprising. What was surprising, however, was just how complex and elaborate this piece of software was. Sergey realized that they were way in over their head. They were just a small little firm in not Dolores, not her Eastern European covenant. It was Belarus. That's the one. So What made the virus so alarming?
Sorry, I'm just looking up to find out if I'm right or not. It seems like it's because the apps don't access. So I was kind of right. The apps don't access the root account. Like there's no like there's no like when you have different accounts on your on a PC back in the day on Windows, but they all access the same registry, right. The same core operating system.
Right.
With Linux, they don't have if you have a user, your user account doesn't have access to the root files. The root system related files doesn't have access to that. So they only the viruses that only affect their user account that they're installed on. So that's just there's no point.
Okay. Well, these obviously, like we established, were running Windows machines, and Sergey realized when he uncovered this virus that they were way in over their head, the little small firm in Belarus. What made the virus so alarming were three things, okay? We'll outline them. One, it possessed a digital certificate that was completely valid. That is to say, it appeared to the computer to be a completely verified program. It was later found out that this digital certificate, which is basically a registered identity, was stolen from an obscure software company in Taiwan to make it seem legit. The second
scary part of... Who gives these certifications out? Microsoft?
I believe it is Microsoft because it has to run on their system.
Yeah, well, I think it's...
That I could be wrong
about.
Well,
you can run things that weren't certified if you want it to. I mean, you could tell Windows, don't run anything that isn't certified.
Yeah, and it'll say, like, this has a digital certificate or not. You're right. Yeah, so it has to be registered with
Microsoft. There's, like, a certification process that things have to go through, even with, like, Xbox games. So if you're playing Call of Duty and there's an update that comes out, that update had to go through the certification process at Microsoft before it's pushed out to your machine, just to make sure shit like this doesn't happen, essentially.
Well, yeah, and so it's scary. That's what was so ridiculous, is this dude's like, hold on, I'm in over my head, because this thing has a valid digital certificate.
How did they forge the digital digitals? Because the digital certificate is fingerprinted to the software. How? Yep.
They didn't forge it at all. They stole their certificate data from this software company in Taiwan, and so the computer just thought it was running this other piece of software.
Wow, okay.
That was valid.
How does it know? Does it have a certain amount of bytes that the software is? Like, did they write the virus to have the same exact amount of bytes as the...
I don't know what I'm saying, right?
Like, the digital fingerprint of the software. Like, how do they do that?
So, my understanding... Yeah, because, like, you can't... Otherwise, you could just rip off anyone's digital certificate and use it in the virus.
There had to have been, like, something that they did with the digital fingerprint. We probably don't know, and we probably won't know how they did that.
Yeah, the second scary thing about this virus is that it exploited a vulnerability in the Windows operating system itself called a zero day. Have you ever heard the term zero day?
Yes, but explain.
The term zero day is known in the software world. It's referring to a severe vulnerability in an operating system or in a program. And the term itself, zero day, refers to the number of days that the vendor has to fix it. They can be thought of as like a bank vault. So once you realize someone knows the code to your vault, you would immediately want to change it and like fix
the
problem.
I'm going to use that
so
in
that's
Overcrest
what a zero day
work
is.
That we have. I'm just going to assign everything.
Right, this is a zero day
this
problem.
This is a zero day problem.
Zero day.
Everything Jake has to do is now zero day.
That's going to be troublesome. There's no way I could do everything I have to do in 24 hours, Chris. That's the problem. So yeah, this virus exploited an issue in Windows. And the problem is, most of these zero days, these bugs that you find, again, as soon as someone finds out, like, oh, this is being exploited, they'll immediately patch it. This had been running, keep in mind, for over 3 years on this bug that they didn't know about. And I don't think I even mentioned it until later, but what's really bizarre about this code and the reason they knew this virus was so different is it used three different zero-day bugs that were identified to make sure that it had full access. Which, if you're creating a virus to do something, these zero days are like super, super rare, and they're super valuable. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you use one, it's going to be patched. So to use three and basically waste them just to ensure it gets done is like crazy to any software engineer.
Yeah, if you have anything that's like a zero-day thing that could do anything with power plants and this stuff, this is where the dark web is pretty scary, because this stuff is...
Yeah, because you sell
this
these.
They're literally for sale now. There's actually ads for sale, or like classifieds that say, hey, if you have... Dark web, confirm this exists. The classified ad says, if you have a zero-day virus that will affect U.S. or Western infrastructure, we will pay $150 million for it right now, and they'll pay them in Bitcoin immediately.
Right. Yep.
And it's probably Russia or China or whatever. But this, like, these ads are up. They're waiting for it to happen. They're waiting for somebody to develop these 100%. Things. And it is super, super scary. And there's dudes sitting at Microsoft right now. They're just sitting there with their arms crossed. There's a patch team, probably, that is in a room just waiting for it to happen so they can, like, bam, boom, fix it immediately.
There's one.
You know, that's...
Exactly. And so, yeah, the knowledge that you have or know about one of these bugs and how to basically exploit the system is so valuable, like you're saying, like millions and millions of dollars if you have this knowledge. And this team, whoever wrote this mystery piece of software, this malware, used three of them when one would have done the trick. So it's bizarre. Like, why would you ever waste that? The third and final thing that made this virus so scary was the sheer size and complexity of it. It had over 150,000 lines of code for a virus. Wow. That's 10 times larger than the typical malware virus. So it's huge.
So are we going to talk about the actual functionality of what this virus was doing? Okay.
Yes.
I think that's really, really special and unique.
Fascinating. Yeah. It's fascinating. But I wanted to kind of tell the story and set the stage here. I have no idea how long we even are into this, but it's exciting. Sergey and his company, Virus Blockada, immediately put the word out. Microsoft hurriedly announced that its engineers were working around the clock for a patch, as you discussed, while antivirus vendors began to analyze the actual malware that surveys discovered. This was the most sophisticated virus ever developed. It was dubbed Stuxnet, which was simply a combination of two random words found in its code. And in order to understand Stuxnet, it had to be reverse engineered, which was a Herculean effort in itself, right? So you have all of this code that you basically have to take apart and figure out what it's doing so that you know what this virus is supposed to infect. And what the analysis found was just astonishing. When Stuxnet was loaded on a computer, it accessed the local network, skipping from computer to computer, copying itself, hence it being classified as a worm. However, unlike most malware, it wasn't actually doing anything. It didn't lock out operating systems or steal information. It just kept spreading. So the question was why? Like, what was it doing? It was found that Stuxnet was programmed to remain dormant until it found a very specific set of criteria. Now, remember, these are like antivirus software engineers that are trying to figure out what it's looking for and what it's doing. And they're going down this list of what it needs to find in order to deploy. And you're like, why would any virus ever be this hyper specific? So this is what Stuxnet's looking for. First, it checked whether a software called Step 7, made by Siemens, was installed on the PC. Okay, so that's one. Does it have this software? If Step 7 was on the PC, Stuxnet hacked it using a secret password that was built into the software that, A, by the way, I didn't even go into this, was not ever supposed to exist. So, like, somehow this was also built into Siemens, and, like, this password, this backdoor, was not supposed to ever exist.
Do you think...
So it's looking for Step 7.
Siemens is an American company.
Yes, I mean, yes, I know, like, where you're going.
Let's
with this.
Be honest here,
and let's
right?
leave I mean, it for
at
now.
Some point. Some dude from the United States government went over to Siemens and said, "Hey,
so
let's do this, right?"
Yeah, maybe. So, okay, it's looking for Siemens on this network. Once it was able to find it, it hacked into the software. Then, using Siemens Step 7, it looked for a specific type of control equipment called a PLC, which is a physical something computer. I didn't write it down. It's basically, it's a small, like, control board used to translate commands to a physical machine. Okay. It's an interface, basically.
So it's like an
Arduino, you have a computer, you'll
basically
hook it up. Yeah, it's like a little board or something that controls a machine.
If then.
So
if
stuff
this is happening, do this.
Yep. So Stuxnet, if it found Siemens 7, if it then found this PLC, it took over that individual little PLC. Once Stuxnet took over the PLC, it looked for two microchips that control the rotation speed of engines made by two specific companies, Vacon from Finland and Faro from Paya, which is an Iranian company. If Stuxnet did not find these two microchips, or if the microchips were made by some other company, Stuxnet would terminate its operation and erase itself from the computer, which is why it was virtually impossible to discover, right? Because it's like spreading, not on this computer, boom, vanished. If Stuxnet found the two microchips, it continued to look for an even more specific condition. The rotation speed of the engines connected to the microchips had to be between 807 and 1210 hertz. Once again, if it didn't find the engines, or if the rotation speed of these engines it controlled were not within the range, it would terminate and erase itself from the computer. So it is so specific, and it's so well engineered, that it's after a obviously very specific target.
Where in the United States was the fake lab with these centrifuges in it?
Yeah.
Were they tested this?
Yes.
That had to have existed. Yes. Like, they, I mean,
I know it did. And you're going to love this story when I get to it. So, but think about, again, where we're at. You're the software engineer reverse engineering Stuxnet at the antivirus company, and you figure out what it's doing. You figure out that this is what it's looking for. The level of precision of the targeting was, to say the least, not typical at all for a computer virus. According to Andrew Ginter, who's an industrial systems security expert, Stuxnet was the result of a huge investment in time, money, and expert IT programmers. Quote, I developed software for 25 years. I wrote software. I managed teams that wrote software. I know how much it costs to produce software. This worm installed cleanly on every machine we threw at it. Everything from Windows NT up to the Windows OS of the day, all of different variants. It installed clean and it ran clean on all of them. I know how hard it is to produce a legitimate product that works on that wide a variety of equipment. My estimation is that there were tens of millions of dollars spent on the software development of Stuxnet.
It took years too. It took like 5 years. It was, and there, nobody knows who these people are. There's no like, hey, I designed this stuff.
No, nope. But okay, again, you were just finding this virus in the wild and you see how sophisticated it is. So you're asking who has the amount of time, money, and resources to develop a program that was so advanced and tailored to target such a specific instance? And the answer, I'm sure you can kind of guess by now. Stuxnet was the first instance of state nation-owned cyber warfare.
Pretty wild, man.
Prior to Stuxnet, the idea of using a computer virus against an enemy was a bizarre concept.
In my opinion, this is kind of like the Manhattan Project. The way that it was developed and the way that it was designed was kind of like the Manhattan Project, where nobody really knew about it. There's these dudes. They probably got a lab out in the middle of nowhere. And they've got like a couple of these centrifuges with these controllers, with these motors, with these chips, with these things, with the picture of the guy on the glass that looks like a footballer. I mean, they
had to have him too, just to set the whole
stage. You got to set the stage, because otherwise they don't have any way to test this. It has to be testable.
Correct. It is. And there are some previously unreleased documents that have come out. And I know the size of this project.
Okay.
And it is mind-boggling. So, again, the concept up till now of using, like, software to hamper an enemy or, like, to target something is bizarre. That said, the Bush administration was open to the operation but was understandably skeptical. So recently declassified documents tell of a dramatic meeting in the White House Situation Room late in the Bush presidency. When asked if the program could even work, the team, who again has never been named, we don't know who they were, but we know they were U.S. covert ops or like U.S. someone employed by the DOD. They're in the Situation Room. Bush is there. He goes, would this thing even work? What they did was open a bag and empty out in front of the president pieces of destroyed centrifuges.
Aha! See? They did have the pieces of destroyed centrifuges. There was a lab.
100% there was. And it was at this point that the U.S. gave the go-ahead for Operation Olympic Games.
Operation Olympic Games. I love that. That's pretty,
that was the name of it.
Was there any like etymology, like a reason for that name or anything like that?
No, and that's the whole point is, I think we did a little mini history or I looked into it at one point. The whole point is it's generated by two random.
Olympic Games is not like, too random anything.
No?
Yeah, well, it's.
Well, you're right. Like, it's obviously Olympic Games. It's not like Olympic Toaster. I don't know. But the whole point usually is like that it's not indicative of what the operation is.
Yep.
Because if you heard or saw classified Operation Olympic Games,
maybe it was something to do with like
Operation Computer, you know, hacking situation.
So much of the Olympic Games in the days with Greece,
purpose of being top secret,
was like wrestling and fighting and like, and they would go into a ring and they'd fight each other under the view of the gods. I would like to think that that's what they were after.
I don't think so at all.
No. All right.
No, I don't. All right. So. Operation Olympic Games, and I'm going to tell you about this in operation, but I want you to play the first audio, or I guess it'd be the second audio file, just to, again, kind of set the stage here for the description, Chris.
Oh, Jesus. All right. All right. Come on, nerd. Get going.
All right, so Operation Olympic Games was a collaborative effort among NSA, the CIA, and Israel. While developing the virus was one thing, hacking into the Iranian complex was a completely different story. The facility was air-gapped, or in other words, it wasn't hooked up to any external network. The virus couldn't be sent digitally.
Right, because these things are in a bunker off. You don't put anything critical infrastructure on a network, right? You don't
exactly.
do that.
And do you know what this reminded me of exactly? Play the last video clip there, because you will. It's just 100% out of a
Before
movie.
We do that, I invited a special guest to come talk to us.
Can I
bring him in?
Just right.
Can I bring him in?
Sure. Right. Bring in your special guest,
Mr. Ben Powell. How's it going, man? I was thinking about you.
It's going well.
Jake dropped an episode on me today, and we're talking about Stuxnet. And when you visited Minneapolis, you were doing clandestine things. And as a person that does clandestine things, why don't you tell us a little bit about your qualifications? And then I want to know, from your perspective, what you think of the Stuxnet program and how it all went down.
All right. So starting with my qualifications, I have a bit of a background in cybersecurity. I started in 2009 and started with the military, did some government contracting, and now have shifted into commercial cybersecurity.
Does that make you a white hat?
So,
yes.
White hat
hacker. That does, yes. A white hat hacker would be considered.
Do you have a white hat? So, you have a white hat?
Chris.
I would.
Okay. Chris thinks he's surprising me by bringing you into this conversation. What Chris doesn't know is Ben actually helped me.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's incredible. All right. Well, that's perfect. Like I'm super interested in like what someone that's in this field has to say about this. And, you know, Jake and I talked a little bit about the dark web and how there's classified ads up right now for zero hour programs. And I kind of want to know what your thoughts. Zero hour would be even worse, I guess, because then you only have an hour to fix it. You don't even have a day to fix it. Is this stuff just lying out there right now and wait? Like, what are your thoughts on this entire concept?
The entire concept. So starting with Stuxnet specifically, what I find fascinating about it was really the first time you had this crossover between the cybersecurity / internet to a physical effect on a target. And so what you see is that's typically known as a system called SCADA, which stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. And that's what controls your power plants, your water treatment plants, your a lot of the manufacturing conveyor belts, manufacturing equipment will have a SCADA system attached to it. And so that's how you have this transition from these kind of fake cybersecurity concepts into a real live effect on a physical target.
Did this happening have an effect on people that have these SCADA systems? Was there like, oh my God, this, like around the world, was there a huge effect that caused a ripple effect to make people scared or do anything? And did anything happen?
Big time.
Oh, massive. This was, I'd say, one of the defining moments in cybersecurity. Because previous to this, it was kind of just this concept that nation states, so most anyone who is going to perform an attack of this level is going to be backed by a nation or a state, North Korea, China, Russia, the US, Israelis, you know, you name it, each country is going to have their own cyber program where they're going to be pushing the kind of the bleeding edge of what's possible.
How in trouble are we?
I mean,
well, it's just
things could be better. The issue you have is what we call business debt, is that these systems are just legacy. For example, like these database servers that run some of these utilities plants have records for like the past 50 years. So it's not just something that they can easily turn off and change overnight. So they require a really long-term planning for migrating off of these systems. And so that's what creates these openings, is that you know for a fact it's going to be around and these systems are going to be old and unpatched. And doing maintenance on them is difficult because no one wants to take down the conveyor belt that's moving the car parts down the line in order to update the firmware or the software on it. Right. So we just don't. Until it breaks, there's no reason to address it. And when it breaks, it's usually kind of a catastrophic.
Have you seen anything in Congress or the executive branch that has been like a something that's reaching out to these companies being like, hey, we're actually, I know you don't want to turn these power plants off, but guess what? It is now the law that you need to keep your shit updated. You need to call up Bill Gates, get the patch, you know, do your shit. Otherwise, we're going to have to shut you down. Is there any, because this stuff seems absolutely yes. critical to get done.
Yeah, I mean, you absolutely nailed it. So there's CISA, which is the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, okay. I think is what CISA stands for. But basically, they're tasked with creating what are called binding operational directives, or BODs. And these BODs are pushed out specifically to what we would call critical infrastructure. So that's going to be your defense manufacturing, your utilities, your sort of anything that could actually have a real effect on American society. And so anyone who is one of these and is sponsored by government money has some level of responsibility to applying these binding operational directives.
Is there any like fiscal or regulatory penalty if they don't?
Not that I'm aware of.
So what's the enforcement mechanism?
Actually happen. It is shaking a big stick, you know? We'll threaten. Eventually, maybe something will happen. Yeah.
In your knowledge, is there anything that's happened?
And Ben, so I'm still going to tell the rest of the story here on Stuxnet, which, by the way, I was going to give you a shout out at the end, but Chris apparently beat me to it here. One thing I do want to ask you though, or mention, you know, Chris asked about like, well, what has been done to secure these places, or has this ever become an issue afterward? I believe, and you would know better than I, wasn't there a very similar, in the same vein that it was targeting the control network of a water treatment plant or something in the U.S. that happened not too long after this?
No, that I believe was Oldsmar, Florida. Was the location of that, and yes, that's exactly what happened. Is the SCADA system, the attackers were able to modify the amount of chemicals being pumped into the water treatment to essentially unsafe levels. But if I remember correctly, it was caught and stopped.
It wasn't like bleach sort of during COVID time or anything, was it? No.
No.
Okay.
No. Well, we would have taken COVID out if we had done that, though. That would have cured it.
So how in danger are we? Are you aware of anything that has happened that, you know, like the citizens don't know about? Is this stuff kind of like, oh shit, sweep this under the rug, we don't want no alarm?
What is he going to say? Yes, but I can't tell you? Like, what?
No, I mean, that's exactly what it is. 100% that's the case. It's like, yes, sure. There honestly, there is no... Currently, there's no regulatory disclosure for private companies. So if a private company has a breach or a private company has an incident, there's no actual responsibility to the customers, to the clients, maybe the shareholders. But if they can keep them quiet, they would prefer to keep them
that
quiet.
That seems like
absolutely it's just bad press.
Serious lapse of responsibility.
SolarWinds would be a good example. SolarWinds was a big breach, really hammered their reputation, and rightly so. I mean, it was kind of just poor practice.
I think we should just arrest anybody that's walking around with a thumb drive at this point. Nobody needs a thumb drive, right? I mean, if you have a thumb drive,
okay, so
what are you doing anymore? Our phones have tons of storage, terabytes. What do you need a thumb drive for?
To get you to plug it into your computer so I can hack you.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right, Ben, I appreciate it, man.
We call those
go ahead. You call it what?
I was gonna say, yeah, they're called rogue apples, road apples. You drop them in parking lots and put some company logos on them, and then absolutely we'll have a beacon on them, and when you plug it in, it'll beacon out and call home and
yeah.
Go so to town.
You're just saying like people, oh, what's this? Well, let's see what's on here. Maybe it's naked pictures. I gotta find out. It very well could be. And then
today, before I joined the call, I was working on a QR code for a phishing email. So we'll send the email with a QR code. You scan the QR code and it takes you to my phishing website that looks like Microsoft login. And then you log in and give me your credentials.
Well, and you could make so much money, Ben, if you weren't so nice.
You can make so much money.
I know you
ransomware,
can.
Right? Like that's why ransomware is a thing. Is really, it's just easy and opportunistic. So it won't ever stop until we get better security.
No, last thing, Ben, and then we'll let you go, is because I didn't cover this in the story, but, you know, when Stuxnux came out and when it was released that, you know, this is what it's doing and this is how it's transferred via USB port, companies, there were people and networks that mandated that they were gluing their USB ports shut on all of their company-owned computers. Like, because nobody knew, there was no fix, there was no antivirus software at the time that could counteract it. And so they were literally gluing USB ports shut.
That is wild.
Still to the day, it is a policy to disable USB ports on laptops, like corporate assets. If you don't need them, we disable them. Because again, really? To your point, like there's enough network storage, there's enough, you know, Dropbox and Box and Microsoft OneDrive that we don't really need to have USB ports.
But so, we do have our passwords as password 1234, which is not a good password for your OneDrive with critical information. I mean, isn't that how Podesta got hacked? Didn't Podesta have who was working with Hillary Clinton? But didn't he have like a very simple password? And that's how Hillary Clinton got hacked, right?
I also believe that he posted on Reddit about how to remove emails from the email server. So, you know, I don't know that her IT team was the sharpest tools in the shed.
Well, they knew how to use BleachBit, so at least they had that going for them. Ben, thank you for piping in and coming to hang out. By the way, you look dapper as hell. You look good.
Oh, thank you.
You do look. I didn't even recognize you.
the beard's gone.
Yeah, big thanks for turning me on to this topic as a whole and helping with some of the initial research. So,
absolutely.
Cool. Thank you,
take care, buddy.
Y'all have a great day. See ya.
All right, see ya.
There. I was like typing like fervently. I'm like, dude, you should come on right now. We're talking about this stuff.
Yeah, no. So I was going to be like, Ben Powell turned me on to this concept and helped so initial research. Okay, hold on, though. I need to get my head straight. Is that Ben with the 964 that was on the rally in the flip-flops?
Yeah.
Mind blown.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, let's get back to Stuxnet. And we're talking about Operation Olympic Games.
Yes.
Right. And so this is in the days of actually planning using Stuxnet as a cyber weapon against this Iranian enrichment facility. And like I said, the facility itself is completely air gapped. There's no network to it, which is why, as you alluded to, someone needs to go there physically with a USB drive. This completely reminded me of the video clip 3 that I need you to play right now.
You froze there for a second, Jake. Keep going.
Play clip 3. By the way, Ben was perfectly clear on my end.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's always worse than you think. Otherwise, there'd be no movies.
So what followed was an international espionage saga that was coordinated by multiple collaborating governments, better than any Hollywood blockbuster.
I'm going to go with Mossad. That's what I'm going to go with. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Intelligence sources from the CIA and Israeli Mossad found that the centrifuges at Natanz were based on designs stolen from a Dutch company in the 1970s.
Hey, the thing we designed, we did some research on the thing that we designed. Here's what we came up with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they stole it. Yeah, Pakistani scientist Abdul Qadir Khan. Khan stole the designs to build Pakistan's nuclear program, then proceeded to market them to other countries, including, of course, Iran and Libya. The Dutch intelligence agency, known as AIVD, A-I-V-D, so it's not AIVD, it's AIVD, along with U.S. and British intelligence, infiltrated Khan's supply network of European consultants and front companies who helped build the nuclear programs in Iran and Libya. So this is like really deep tradecraft espionage stuff where they're going and creating shell companies to infiltrate this dude's network who then interfaces with Iran. So an operative then, posing as a mechanic working for a front company doing work at Natanz, covertly uploaded the virus into the system.
That's wild.
From there, Stuxnet took over. It spread across the entire system undetected, replicating and deleting itself until it found the centrifuge controllers. Each of these controllers dictates the power and frequency sent to the drive motors, effectively controlling their
speed. This went to more than just one facility, too, by the way. So this was like, was a guy plugging the USB drive in or whatever, knowingly or unknowingly, probably unknowingly. They probably like broke into this guy's house and like, you know, found his wife's laptop and put it on his wife's laptop. And then his wife probably emailed the guy. And it probably went through all kinds of different hoops. I don't think anybody was hanging from a string above a central server, but there's definitely some crazy shit that went on to get this stuff done.
There, I found, whether it can be trusted or not, I did find one declassified report that it was a specific mole that was put in place by the CIA and Mossad to go in there like as a mechanic. Like it was a guy being a covert dude.
Oh man, that's, imagine what that, I wonder what he got
it's
paid.
Wild.
You know, what did he get paid?
Yeah,
he got paid because he got like a $350,000 house in the middle of Illinois and a name change and $1 million in
exactly.
the bank. That's what that
exactly.
guy's got.
Yes. So what Stuxnet actually did, like we're talking about the payload now. We knew that it was going to target the Iranian facility and we needed to basically shut down these enrichment centrifuges. So what it did was shift the normal operating speed of the centrifuge from 63,000 RPM to 84,600 RPM specifically for 15 minutes at a time. At that precise speed, Chris, the rotors in the centrifuge would reach the resonance frequency, causing harmonics and vibration, flexing the rotors just enough to hit the wall of the cylinders at, mind you, 84,000 RPM, and it would basically explode and just fail catastrophically.
And they're like, hey, who made the bearings on these things? These things are shit.
Yeah, what the heck is going on? Well, entering the entire process, the virus would also...
Our bearings are bad. Send us these Russian bearings and these stupid things.
What's going on,
they're not working out. You got to send us some new ones. Talk to Gruber over there. Get some German bearings instead.
So during the entire process, the virus would also spoof the RPM readouts so the operators would have no idea why the components failed. Everything was in the green, or so it seemed. Like the RPMs didn't change on the readouts. But the real genius of the attack was in its subtlety. So they could have programmed all the machines to overspeed and blow up right away. And that would have been it. That would have like taken the whole system down, but it would have been obvious. Instead, by causing smaller scale, persistent failures, the virus was never discovered. And enrichment was delayed just enough to never make critical yield, right? They never got to that 20% enrichment. Furthermore, the virus acted as an effective psychological weapon. Think about it. These Iranians, as we're talking about, running the program could not figure out the failure for the life of them. They lost confidence in their own nuclear abilities and were ultimately defeated both from a morale perspective and tactically.
It's brutal. Just absolutely brutal.
It's
a mind
brutal
game.
And
it's
brilliant.
Chess.
100%. It's so genius. So in the end, Stuxnet worked. It was the world's first cyber weapon and remained undetected for years. But the fact that it was detected, Chris, brings up a very interesting question and another basically chapter to the story. So think about it. For all the resources and planning that went into the Operation Olympic Games, it seems odd that a small antivirus company was able to discover in a completely unrelated industry this virus.
Keep going. You're good.
So for how sophisticated Stuxnet was, it should have remained undetected, right? The fact that it was accidentally, quote unquote, discovered seems kind of just sloppy for a multi-million dollar project that went undiscovered for years and years. Unless you consider the possibility that it may not have been an accident at all.
They wanted it to be discovered? How? Why?
Exactly. What ultimately led to the virus's detection was a supposed propagation error. So we're going to talk about technically why it was discovered. Rather than remain within the closed network of the Iranian enrichment facility, it somehow got out. And once it infected a computer that was connected to the internet, it, of course, spread like wildfire. So to maintain its stealthiness, the virus was programmed initially to only replicate itself to three other computers each time, which kind of created a sort of controlled spread, right? Instead, the bug in the program left it to replicate itself unrestricted. It would copy itself anywhere and everywhere that it could. This is how it started causing computers to crash, because now it's using all its memory to keep, you know, propagating, and how our security expert, Sergey, uncovered
it. Had a memory leak, Jake.
So how?
It had a memory leak. That's my guess. You know, it's like when you have a computer software that's crashing, you know, when you go to a car and you're like, dude, just check your grounds. Just check your grounds. With software, it's, it's always
exactly. It's like electrical
it's always
leak.
A memory leak.
Yes,
always.
Exactly. So, okay, again, to your question. So how, or perhaps more importantly, why did this mistake happen? When American and the Soviets were engaged in the Cold War, Chris, the space race kind of served as a sort of public counterpart. So while espionage and nuclear threats were happening behind closed doors, the world watched the two sides in their efforts to be the first to conquer space. And think about this for consideration. When Sputnik was launched into orbit, making Soviets the first to do so, America and the world optimism was completely shattered. Regardless of what we now know, it seemed that the superiority of the Soviets' technical abilities was completely demoralizing to the Western world. And so, you have to ask yourself, if you created and successfully deployed the world's first cyber weapon, having already completed its mission, would it perhaps serve a bigger purpose
to leak own it.
Its very existence?
Just, hey, exactly. This whole time, it was me. It was
guess
me.
So
at least the guys, you know, you think if they nobody ever knew, these poor guys that designed it would have to. They're just eating their dinner with their wife. And Lois is like, John, what's wrong? And he's just like, nobody.
He's like,
I can't
tell you.
I can't. She honestly thinks he's a vacuum salesman. Right. She thinks he's selling Hoovers downtown on Main Street to all the ladies. And nope, he's actually a CIA code hacker, white hat, just like Ben. Maybe Ben did it.
So I know, because guess what?
We'll never
know. They can't ever
we'll
release
never know.
Who
Maybe
did
it was Ben.
What if Ben did it? Why did Ben turn me onto the story in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It all comes around.
So. There, by the way, there's no concrete evidence that the intentional leak is what happened, but it certainly makes for a really compelling theory.
Oh, propaganda.
So as soon as
Stuxnet
code was reverse engineered.
As much as physical results.
Right, because, so while there was no public, announcement, we're taking credit for it, as soon as the code was reverse engineered by these experts, it became clear that it was the product of a nation state, and the origin, although not immediately revealed, was kind of clear, right? Who would have the capability to do this? Okay, it was the U.S. So since then, cyber warfare has continued to progress and be implemented by various groups around the world, from nation states to more nefarious organizations, as Ben alluded to as well. You know, China continues to be held responsible for a string of cyber attacks on a number of public and private institutions in the U.S., India, and Russia. And while the 2016 election also saw Russian influence via digital means, social media, etc., as a type of cyber warfare.
However, that was known to be pretty minuscule. That was known, but they did try. I'm more concerned now of artificial intelligence influence. How are we going to know if anything is real unless we, I walk up to you and grab your cheek in person and just make sure you're not have one of those masks you can rip
you're
off
grabbing
on Mission
my cheek
Impossible.
Instead of whatever else you're going to allude to there. So what's interesting, yes, those were minuscule in comparison to Stuxnet, because we still haven't seen a direct weaponization on the scale of Stuxnet since its discovery. Or perhaps, and maybe more likely, there are other covert operations currently underway or never having been discovered.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Like if there was another operation to this level and we already kind of claimed like we have this capability, it probably wouldn't serve the purpose to say we did this or we can do
this. There's got to be a reason regardless, that China doesn't have any silicon. They're not making any. It's all in Taiwan. It's all in Singapore. China just can't seem to get their shit together. Why?
I wonder why, Chris. Yeah, I mean, it makes you question kind of like these other things that aren't seemingly direct attacks. Like, what else is going on behind the scenes?
Indeed.
Regardless, the rise of Stuxnet and cyber warfare itself has forever changed the course of history as we know it. And that is why.
Indeed. That's a great story. I've been reading about this actually a little bit a little while ago, so it was really cool to get an even deeper dive into it. Thanks for putting that together.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a fun one. All right, guys. Well, be sure to check us out on the Drivers Club as well, where there are actually still exclusive episodes and more history stories that haven't ever been shared on the air. And of course, our news segments that we do also have extended features on there as well. Check it out at overcrestproductions.com/drivers club. What are we doing next week,
Chris? We have some news and some current events and some... Well, honestly, we already recorded it, and it's mainly me yelling at you about a boat. So it's the boat episode, apparently.
Well, no, I thought that was being released before this one. Like, now we're time traveling.
I don't know which one's coming up. Okay. I have no idea. We have who knows? I know coming up, we have the new editor-in-chief at The Drive is going to be coming on the podcast. The Drive is making a comeback. We have the guy that designs all the aero for Williams F1 is going to be coming on the podcast very soon. We have a lot of cool guests coming up. I'm pretty excited about it.
That's super interesting. Awesome. Well, thank you.
I'm supposed to say thank you, and then you say take care.
I know. I'm all thrown off here.
We will see you guys next week.
Take care.
That's how it's done.
How about that? How about that?